We made this.
Welcome to One Rules Them All, a brand new Lord of the Rings podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host today, Luke Winch, and joining me today to discuss episode 4 is Sam Stokes. How are you, Sam?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Luke, except for a bit of a cold. But as long as it is a cold and not the darkness of Sauron spreading in me, then I'm okay.
Definitely, definitely. I very much doubt it's the darkness of Sauron just yet. So.
Oh, yeah.
But nothing will stop us from talking about Lord of the Rings and the Rings of Power.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So, I mean, before we kind of get into the show, what's your relationship with Tolkien and Lord of the Rings? Are you a big fan of the books, or did you just get through it through the films? What's your history?
Yeah, I got into it through the films. So I'm an absolutely huge fan of the films. I'm someone who watches the extended edition trilogy about three or four times a year. Yeah, I mean, the thought of watching the not extended versions now is just horrendous. couldn't even imagine it anymore. So yeah, I've watched those countless times, and the Hobbit trilogy. And I'm a growing fan of the books. You know, sometimes you come to things late, you kind of, when you do access it, you know, whether it be a TV show or books or whatever, you kind of think I've always been a fan. I just hadn't got there yet. So I'm currently finishing off the Silmarillion and I've loved every page of it. So that pretty much sums it up. Yeah.
Yeah. The Silmarillion's an interesting one because it's quite a dense book, isn't it? Compared to Lord of the Rings. I mean, the first half of it reads like a kind of historical anthology of events, doesn't it? And almost like, you know, the birth of the world in the Bible or something like that. So it's quite dense. And then you get into like some of the first age stuff with Morgoth and stuff. And then it starts getting really, really kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful creation story in the first parts. And then the historical accounts, I'm sure some people would find it dry, even people who like the novels, but I don't. I relish every single little detail that gives even more life and even more substance to these characters and these places and these tales that, you know, we know and love from the films and the novels. So it's just, yeah, I just love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way that people like yourself are discovering the books and all the different stories that go with it through the films and kind of going backwards through it. And I love that because I think if you love the films, then you should definitely read the books because they just add so much richness and depth to what the films actually achieved as well.
Yeah, it really does. And I take a positive and enriching approach to it, I guess. I don't get hung up on the differences between the films and the books or anything like that. I mean, now that I'm a bit more well-read on Tolkien, there might be a few things in Rings of Power that if they border on contradicting what we know, I might get a little bit uncomfortable. But generally speaking, I'm just enjoying the ride, whether it be the books or Rings of Power.
Yeah. I mean, how are you getting on with the Rings of Power then? What's your kind of brief thoughts about where we are so far?
I am pleasantly surprised. I was very nervous going into it, like most Tolkien fans, but you know, they spent a hell of a lot of money, and it does seem like a good chunk of that was well spent, not least on the you know, the people making it and the people writing it have some reverence for the source material and some respect. It's a great challenge for them to put this into the medium of a TV show. Obviously, they didn't have to, so I'm not exactly, oh, poor Amazon having to take on this massive challenge. But I think cautiously, I would say they're doing a good job so far.
Yeah, I think I would agree, actually. I think depending on who you talk to, depending on your realms of social media, there are polarizing views of the Rings of Power. And I think people are either really enjoying it and they're really enjoying what we're getting on screen, and some people are just not liking it at all. And as long as they've got valid reasons for not liking it, I don't mind that. That's fine. But if it starts getting into racial hate and just hating on it for the sake of hating on it, then I just dismiss those claims completely. But it's a very interesting labyrinth to go through, the social media, when it comes to the Rings of Power.
I've generally tried to steer clear. I mean, you know, you see headlines and it's just, even just delving into it for 2 or 3 minutes, it's a bit upsetting, you know. Some of the reasons, I say reasons, I mean, reasons is a flattering word, really. But the things they're saying, it's just bile, isn't it? And I've got every bit of time for healthy discussion about the show and its writing and pacing and casting and all that, but not all that horrible stuff that's on social media.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about today's episode, which is episode 4, The Great Wave. Before we kind of go into a deep dive into all the different narrative strands that we have in this, what's your overall thoughts of this episode?
I really enjoyed it. For one thing, it was nice to get back to the dwarves and Khazad Dûm. And I'm not enjoying the Harfoots, but it was nice to get a break from them as well, because we've had a lot of them. So it's nice to, you know, we had a break from the dwarves, fine, but it was nice to kind of get an equal break from them, just to focus on, because we got some really good focus on the dwarves and Elrond and Durin's relationship. So that was really nice. And yeah, I just thought it pushed certain storylines forward. It had more forward momentum maybe than the first three episodes. It's pushing along the relationship between Elrond and Durin and Mithril. That's my cat, sorry. It's pushing along the relationship between Elrond and Durin and the Mithril discovery. It's pushing along what Numenor means for this tale. So, yeah, narratively, I enjoyed it. And I thought there's some actors who have already impressed even more in this episode.
100%, yeah. Yeah, Morfydd Clark and Cynthia Adai Robinson particularly for me stood out this episode, as well as the actors who play Deesa and Durin as well. I thought those four, I actually Robert Arameo as well as Elrond, I thought they all were standouts this week for their various scenes. Yeah, this may be my favourite episode so far, I think. I think you're completely right, Sam, in that it's we've had episodes 1 and 2 and to an extent 3 as the setup episodes. We've set up all the characters, we've set up where the narrative strands are going, and now they can actually get into telling the story, I think, now. And I've thought this episode had really good forward momentum. I think it benefits not having the Harfoots in this, because there is a lot of doom-laden prophecy type stuff, and we're really getting into the darkness of what is going to happen across Middle-earth soon, and I really enjoyed that darker tone of this episode. And it was great to have the dwarves back as well. I just love Durin and I love Deesa. They were two of my favourite characters, and it was, yeah, I really, really enjoyed this episode. And the kind of climax of the episode as well, with Miriel and Galadriel, and Miriel's decision, I thought is really just driving stuff forward now. Really loving it.
Yeah, completely agree about the Durin and Deesa and all the dwarf stuff. The more the better. And yeah, it was a really powerful end to the episode, wasn't it, really? Really, really showed the kind of direction that season one's going to continue to go in. And the Numenoreans they've been very resistant from the moment Galadriel arrived, haven't they? They've been quite resistant, and obviously fighting with Halbrand as well. And then there was this kind of powerful moment of a real gesture from Miriel to believe in Galadriel's mission and show solidarity. And with not to get to touch too much on the fine details, but the volunteers at the end as well.
Yeah, I mean, let's kind of dig into that then. Let's dig into Galadriel and the Numenoreans and these things, because I think these scenes take up probably the most chunk of the episode, I think. So we start with Regent Muriel's dream or vision of Numenor's destruction, consumed by the sea that she is seen in the Palantir that we get to see later on. What were your thoughts on how this episode opens? Because we're starting to learn a bit more about Muriel's responsibility and the kind of burden she has to bear for her kingdom.
Yeah, the her vision that we see at the start, it's one of those things where TV shows which are based on source material, I think it kind of, there are moments that mean something for people who know the source material well and for people who don't. So for those of us who have read quite a bit of Tolkien, we know about the fall of Numenor, and we're kind of little hints towards what's going to happen and stuff like that. Like we go, oh yeah, look, oh, this is, we know where this is leading. Nice little vision, a nice little prophecy or foreshadowing, you know. And then even for people who don't know that stuff, it's like, oh my word, like what's this vision all about? Is this going to happen? Is this really going to happen? Surely not. This is not going to happen. So I thought, like, what a way to start the episode. Like, gives a lot of it gives all the viewers something to think about, and about the fate of Numenor. So really, really good attention grabbing way to start the episode.
Definitely. And yeah, as you said, there is resistance from Muriel and from the rest of the people, because we get that we get the guildsmen kind of having a discussion in the square about worries that Galadriel's going to bring all the elves to Numenor and they're going to steal their jobs because they never tire, they never grow old. So I thought that was really interesting, because it really plays into, I mean, you could kind of see it as maybe an allegory to like robotic automated workforces taking our jobs, you know, and that kind of fear that we can lose our jobs to a entity or being that has no way of tiring or aging. And so I found that argument quite compelling, actually.
Yeah, my first reaction honestly was like, oh no, like we've got too much of this stuff in the real world right now, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
These elves want to take our jobs and stuff like that. But I mean, it's worth remembering that Tolkien was bearing in mind certain industrial developments in the country and in the world when he was writing this stuff. So it's not entirely out of character of the universe, let's say. I mean, you know, the tension between Numenor and the elves is an absolutely fundamental part of the story that the Rings of Power is going to tell. So it's good that we get insights into that, what the people, kings and queens or whoever it may be, is thinking, what the people on the streets are thinking. So yeah, even though it's like, you know, oh no, this is just what we get in real life, it was beneficial, I think, for the story.
Yeah, and I kind of like the way that the Councillor Farazan, I think his name is. I like the way he placates them all with wine and pretty words as well, which is quite telling of how to control the mob, as it were.
Yeah,
that was good. So we get an introduction to a new character called Kemen, who is Farazan's son, I believe, and we get a chance meeting between him and Eriyan. Whether or not Kemen's going to become a larger part of the story, what were your thoughts on him as a character and his interactions with Eriyan?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really got to know either of those characters. I know Eriyan's been in since we first saw the Numenoreans, but we've really got, I don't know, 1 or 2 minutes of screen time with Kemen. So yeah, I'm undecided on that. I don't know if you know, if there's a potential for an interesting story where those two connect, and then maybe there's tension between him and his father. You know, they possibly try to end up on opposing sides of that which is going to go down. So it's got potential, but just not a lot to report on yet there.
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, my kind of initial thoughts of Kemen is that he's quite forward.
Yeah.
You know, he's like literally in their second encounter invites her to dinner in a kind of roundabout way. So I thought, oh, okay, you've got some either some arrogance or some balls to, yeah. to do that to a complete stranger. But yeah, those are my initial thoughts on that character. It's just interesting to have him introduced in this episode.
Yeah.
So we get Galadriel trying to convince Miriel to sail to Middle-earth to defeat Sauron. She's brought the old scroll pieces that she discovered in the previous episode with her. And we get, we get some stand-up performances from Morfydd and Cynthia here, particularly Galadriel's There Is a Tempest in Me speech, which I thought was wonderful.
That was very moving. The way she delivers that line. Yeah, she's just got an intensity. I don't know if it's intentionally growing, or I don't know the chronology of when these scenes were filmed, if like her confidence in the role was growing. Something about these scenes in this episode just felt like she'd reached a new intensity. Maybe we're just getting we've kind of got comfortable with the character now, and we feel like we know her and we can just absorb it a little bit better. I'm not sure, but from my perspective, I really felt the intensity of Galadriel. Even more than the previous three episodes, and I absolutely loved it. She is doing such an amazing job in the role.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see Galadriel, the character of Galadriel, in this stage of her life. Very different from the more serene Galadriel that we'll see much later on, thousands of years later. But she's obviously very, very troubled. She realizes she's got this promise to her dead brother to defeat Sauron and the evil. So there's definitely that fire burning in her, and it does make her impatient. It does make her, you know, as Halbrand says, when they're in the prison cells, you know, you gallop everywhere, you pace everywhere, you don't stop to think. And I love that conversation between those two in that prison cell, and Halbrand kind of confronts her about her inability just to stop and think and take control of the situation in a different way rather than just barging in.
Yeah,
and making these horse analogies, which she doesn't like very much, but you know, his message comes across, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was one of my favourite scenes of the episode for a couple of reasons. I mean, one of them, that's probably the funniest line of the episode, when she says, "Cease comparing me to a horse." I love that. But what Halbrand was saying as well was interesting, and there's as you've probably seen, there's a theory about who Halbrand really is. And the way he talks to Galadriel about kind of how to deal with people. And I think he uses the phrase like something like, you need to master them.
Yeah.
And it was just an interesting, perhaps not accidental choice of words that might indicate he's something more than he says to be. So that was very interesting for me. And then, of course, when Galadriel fights her way out, that's a good little mini fight scene as well. So, yeah, I like all of that action.
Yeah, it's quite funny how she overpowers those four gods pretty damn easily and just basically shoves them in the cell. But I quite like that. I mean, it just shows the finesse and the quickness of elves.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that the Chancellor kind of stays his sword, because he's like, I'm not dealing with this. I'm stepping back on this. But I really enjoyed that scene as well. And the theory that you're talking about, is this a theory, spoilers, ladies and gents, well, not spoilers, because it's just a theory that's online, but it's the theory that he may be one of the Nazgul.
Well, yeah.
Or becomes one of the Nazgul, one of the nine mortal men who submits themselves to Sauron.
Absolutely. Or even the theory that goes further, that he could be Sauron. I mean,
oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know how deep to get into things from the book, but you know, it's written that Sauron turns up in Numenor and manipulates and wields his influence and pushes things into the direction that suits him. So Halbrand's told us some stuff about him. Galadriel's supposedly found some stuff about him, but it's just another interesting theory. There's a lot of the show. One of the things the show's doing well is giving us lots of things to guess.
Yeah,
and that's one of them. And I don't really mind if he turns out to be Sauron or the Witch King of Angmar or just some kind of King of the Southlands. It's just fun to read into some of the things he says and perhaps guess what's going on.
Yeah, I think the writers are intentionally, and I like that they're doing this, they're intentionally leading the viewers down different paths and giving us different kind of origins of Sauron to think about, because there's some people who think it might be the Stranger who've yeah. fallen from the stars, and that's mentioned near the end with the old man and Theo. You know, did you see the sign, the falling star? Mm. So some people think that it's a Stranger. I know on our One Rules Them All Discord, there are a lot of people who are convinced the Stranger is Sauron. I'm not convinced at all. I do think that's a red herring. And then you've got Halbrand, who is a possible candidate. You've got Adar, who we'll talk about in a minute once we finish with this section. Mm. Adar is a possibility because yeah. I think it's either in the appendices or in the Silmarillion that Adar was a name that Sauron used when he walked the Earth. So there's lots of candidates and lots of possibilities. And I like that the writers are kind of teasing us with this, and they're kind of playing with us. And I really enjoy that aspect.
Me too. It's smart. It's because, you know, it's, yeah. they've got together in the early stages of making the show and season one. And I think it's you know, I assume someone asked the question, like, how do we give the Tolkien fans what they want? And I think one of the very good answers to that question would have been, well, let's make them guess about who these people are. We'll give them some name, and the Tolkien fans can kind of say, oh, well, you know, there's all these people all these characters that will eventually become down the line. And now we're just sowing the seeds, and we've got these different unannounced characters. And yeah, you and I are clearly enjoying the mystery, and I'm sure a lot of other fans are as well.
Mm, definitely. So let's talk about when Galadriel breaks into the tower and Miriel is there at the bed of Tar Palantir, who is the king, who is clearly fading fast. He's ill, his mind is weak. Mm. And we get to see the Palantir, one of the seven seeing stones. What's your thoughts on this scene and the conversations between Miriel and Galadriel? Again, top performances from both these ladies in this scene.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the takeaways. And another one is just that Miriel has been very guarded up until this moment. And, mm-hmm. but, you know, Galadriel has this passion and conviction and to a certain degree charisma, although it's not, you know, oftentimes a very pleasant one, let's say. It's more of a power. But one way or another, Galadriel kind of opens up Miriel and convinces her to share and take, yeah, and that was just a great interaction. And because I was curious what was going to happen with Miriel. She was very guarded, and I was thinking, is this going to be a bit of a one-dimensional kind of antagonistic character? Mm. But I was just, it was really nice to see how that developed, and then, you know, how it led to the end of the episode. Again, lots of forward momentum there. She started the episode, from what we've seen so far, we didn't know a lot about what she knew, what she wanted. Suddenly, Galadriel's conviction causes her to open up. We see the Palantir, which is a nice little thing. And then we can really start connecting and getting on board with Miriel for now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like how Galadriel finds their connection together, where in the fact that they are both women who are holding, who have this information mm. that is weighing heavily on them, and she's able to connect with Miriel like that. And I really like the way that happens. And yeah. I think that really helps. Even though Miriel at this point hasn't made the decision to help her, I think that's seeded in her mind. And when we get to the end of the episode, I think that really helps with when the petals start to fall of the white tree. That's the clincher for her, that sending Galadriel away on her own is a bad decision.
Yeah, and although what we've seen of Galadriel so far is a very kind of headstrong warrior, we have to remember, like, she's one of the Eldar. I mean, she's mm. very old and very wise. she's not. It's not like a. We're not seeing a very clear kind of wisdom like we do in the Lord of the Rings films from Cate Blanchett, but she is in there. She is very old and wise, and has lived in the light of the trees and all that. So it's no surprise that she can find those connections, and I'd welcome more scenes like that in the future, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we really see what Galadriel will be, I think, in this scene, because she's, you know, and I think she's taken on Halbrand's advice to just stop, slow down, yeah. and be diplomatic in this situation. So, yeah, I welcome more of these scenes with Galadriel, definitely. So is there anything else you want to mention about the Galadriel scenes in Numenor before we move on?
There's an interesting thing that, Miriel, when Galadriel looks and gets the vision in the Palantir, and Galadriel's first reaction is to say, well, this is just a vision, basically.
Mm.
And then Miriel says that it is already come to pass, and then says, your arrival was the start of it. And
yeah.
It maybe because she sees this as inevitable or almost inevitable, maybe that's the foundation behind her willing to change her position completely by the end of the episode. So yeah, that was a line that stuck with me. She's really concerned for Numenor. And I think by the end of the episode, we see her deciding what is the right path to have any chance of saving the fate of Numenor. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, the Palantir is a very interesting one because, as we learn in Lord of the Rings, when Denethor has had a Palantir in Minas Tirith, and he's seen the vision of the downfall of Minas Tirith, the downfall of men, and that drives him mad because he is so convinced of the finality of that vision. And you can kind of look at that with Miriel's looking. She knows this is going to happen, and she's completely, you know, she completely believes in it and the finality of it. So I think that's really playing with what the Palantirs can do and keeping within universal law of Middle Earth and what the Palantirs do. So I really like that touch.
Yeah, you're right. It is in keeping. It resonates with what Denethor sees and what happened to Denethor. I mean, it also resonates a little bit with when the Fellowship is in Lothlorien and they see visions. I can't remember which hobbit it is, but sees a vision of the Shire burning,
Frodo, I think,
which in the film like doesn't come to pass. But so yeah, it makes you think, like, you know, these visions are in keeping with what we know about the universe, about the films. But there's still always that question mark over, is it the future or is it just a possibility? So not, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, it is. And also remember that with the Palantirs, they don't know where the other six are, but it's also a communication device. So whoever, Miriel has been using the Palantir to see this vision, someone else could be watching as well. Someone else could be knowing what Miriel's seeing. So I like that mystery behind it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good mystery.
Yeah, another good mystery. So let's move on then to Elrond and the dwarfs. So we begin with this scene with Celebrimbor and Elrond. And I really like this discussion because there is obviously something troubling Celebrimbor. And I think we get the hint throughout these scenes that King Gil-galad has alternative motives for getting the dwarfs involved. There's, you know, there's a reason why Elrond was brought into this because of his association with Durin. So I like the fact that Celebrimbor he looks unsettled. Elrond picks up on this as well. So there's definitely this ulterior motive underlying the elves' reasoning to have Elrond involved in this project.
Yes, we've seen a bit of Celebrimbor now, and he's you know, on the surface very motivated by just the kind of desire to make something special. But we haven't seen a lot of Gil-galad since the first episode. If anything, I can't quite recall.
No.
But yeah, we're really uncertain over his motives, and it makes me really look forward to the next episode because Durin says he's been invited to Lindon, and I assume to, you know, accompany Elrond and meet Gil-galad for whatever reason. And of course, Elrond knows about the Mithril now, so that is something I'm really looking forward to about the next episode.
Yeah, 100%. And we have a delightful scene between Deesa and Elrond where Elrond is trying to pry the truth from Deesa. There's a wonderful tension in this scene where, you know, and I think Deesa, played by Sophie Nomvetti, she's wonderful. She's so good. And I like the way she keeps her calm, she keeps her cool. She clearly doesn't like lying to Elrond, but it's something she has to do.
Yeah, it's played so well, that scene is. She really is smashing the role, and it's just played so well because the fact that the kids are kind of causing a bit of trouble, she gives herself that little bit of time to think about her response by kind of dealing with the kids, you know, while she's thinking, and then she goes back to Elrond with her response, and it's very, very well played. And yeah, that tension is also very well played. Elrond very boldly says something along the lines of, "I'm sorry, I really can't remember," but something like, "It's not good to keep secrets," to oversimplify it.
Yeah.
And that's very bold. And she's like, "Oh, I'm sorting a dwarf in her own home." And then just when it's kind of the tension might be going over the edge, she says, "Does that answer satisfy you? Would you like to know anything more?" And he just goes, "No," and smiles and dissolves the tension. And it's very well played.
Yeah. That steeliness that she has when she says, is there anything else you want to know, dear? And there's a steeliness behind her. But I like how that steeliness is then you cut to the scene where she's talking to Durin about how she hated lying to Elrond and her worries about it. So, she was very steely in that scene, but her true worries kind of come out when she's talking to Durin. And then we find out that Elrond's got super hearing and can hear the discussion from quite far away.
I was wondering if it was super hearing or reading the mouths.
Or reading the I didn't know which one.
Me neither, but it was sneaky of him. And since we mentioned that little moment, how cool was the dwarves' armor? Those two dwarves that come up to him and like, "Are you lost?" Like the armor and the helmets that open.
Loved it.
Oh, it looks so good. Like matte black color. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. All the dwarven stuff. I mean, the interior of Moria, the armor design is just, it's all absolutely fantastic. I was most looking forward to the dwarf stuff before it even started, because I was like, I want to see Khazad-dûm in its glory, and it's just been breathtaking.
Oh, it hasn't disappointed. Yeah, like the all the mechanics, like the elevators and all how they get around, and the little homes carved into the rock, and the bridges and the trees and waterfalls. It just looks amazing.
Yeah,
well done.
It does. So Elrond finds himself in the old mine under the Miramir Lake, and he gains access. I like how he gains access here, because when you think back to Lord of the Rings and when they're trying to access Moria, it's a word that grants access to the interior of Moria. And I like the way this little, I don't know what you call it, a little kind of chant or whatever, which was, I wrote it down somewhere. "Rich crone, kiss the stone, polish your gems and gold."
Yeah.
And that opens the door. So I quite like that association with words gaining access to these secret places.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I didn't clock on the first watch, I didn't clock how he knew that. And I was almost a bit annoyed. Like, come on, he's not a super hero, like, omniscient being. And then in the second watch, my fiance pointed out the kids are singing it in Durin's home. I was like, clever.
Yeah.
Nice.
Really, really clever. Welcome to the third age of podcasting.
The name of the podcast
is A Dream Given Form,
a show about J. Michael Straczynski's Babylon 5
for the We Made This podcast network.
Join us in 2022 as we look back at themes and ideas from across the show's history.
Today we're going to be discussing the three prominent leaders of Babylon 5. Sinclair, Sheridan and Delenn.
Everything from Earth and the Shadows and Minbari all the way through from early days of Season 1 all the way through to the Interstellar Alliance, and it's their legacy. Interstellar Alliance is really the legacy of these three characters. We are kind of going to potentially some scary territory here, looking at the parallels between Earth Force and Babylon 5 and the real world in which we live in now.
It is a really insidious way of doing things, and the more I think about it and the more I watch that scene and the way that Pierce speaks and talks about it, it really just fills me with chills, because, our politicians do this all the time. They talk like this all the time and they hide their true intention behind false promises. Current situation with the potential reboot of Babylon 5 for the CW network.
He's been involved in comic writing, he's been for Spider-Man, he's done shows like Sense8, which is very progressive as well. He's going to bring all that experience into the project, so I think it's going to be a very different show, and even some special guests too. Lita herself, Patricia Tallman.
I love hearing that people are still interested in Babylon 5, and it's really an honor to continue the conversation around a show that meant so much to us, and it was the little show that could.
Yeah. And then in 2023, join us for the 30th anniversary of Babylon 5 as we start fortnightly look backs at the gathering in Season 1 and beyond.
So join us for A Dream Given Form,
our last best hope for peace.
So Durin finds Elrond there. We get a wonderful scene here where Durin basically tells him to swear an oath that that what he's about to see will never reach outside these walls. And you just get the feeling that that scene is going to be pivotal later on, because, you know, this oath about keeping the Mithril secret, I think is going to have consequences between the relationship between dwarves and elves later on.
Yes, because, I mean, we know that the Balrog, you know, will eventually be a massive part of the desolation of Moria. But we're not clear on how the relationship between the elves and dwarves will break down. Because after a rocky start, Elrond and Durin seem to have a really strong connection. So, yeah, the obvious answer to that question is, well, it's the Mithril. And another really good part of the episode is when Durin shows the Mithril, the piece of Mithril, to Elrond initially, and something comes over Elrond. He looks, from the moment he sees it, he looks absolutely mesmerized.
Yeah.
The way he says, no, it would be Mithril, and he's staring at it. And he comments on, like, the light, and he just looks absolutely absorbed. And it reminds me of the kind of look in Thranduil's face in the Hobbit trilogy whenever he's talking about the Mithril gems. So I feel like there's going to be this weird battle within Elrond about how he deals with this situation.
Yeah, there's you know, the elves are supposed to be this, you know, connected with nature, a love of nature and trees, and not bothered about materialistic gain, but they are entranced by jewels and precious things, you know, like the Silmarils, for instance. And it's almost reminiscent of the seduction of the ring, isn't it? As he looks at this piece of Mithril and he's just entranced. It's a very interesting scene. There's some underlying stuff going on there, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. That's basically this whole section of the episode with Elrond being in Khazad Dûm, and, you know, that scene of the making the oath to Durin, and Durin giving him the piece of Mithril, which is obviously a test. Well, at least clearly from my perspective, the way Elrond looks at it and comments on it, and then what happens after the accident. The cave collapse as well. It's all just brilliant.
Yeah, what did you think to Deesa's kind of singing to the stone scene and this kind of operatic thing? It was really quite moving, wasn't it?
Yeah, that had been very well set up before, when we heard about how they met and how she sings to the stone and comments a bit on that. So we had been made aware of that, and then we actually see it. And the music is very nice, kind of thematically fits with some of the music we hear in the Hobbit trilogy. And then what was interesting to me is the way Elrond, and again, this is to the actor's credit, Elrond looks quite moved by what's happening. And then just at the end of that little sequence, he's looking at the like the dust, like shaking.
Yeah.
And one thought I had was, well, it's just, you know, this is a powerful moment. Like her voice, what she's doing, it's powerful, that you can see it in the rock. But then I had another thought, which is he looks concerned. Is he sensing something? Is he sensing that there's something down there?
Yeah, is he sensing that the dwarves dug too deep?
Exactly. I just thought, are we getting a first hint that Elrond might sense something?
It's a nicely ambiguous little bit of the scene, isn't it? There's several things that could be. Yeah, I had the same kind of thoughts going through as well when I saw that.
That's interesting. Okay. I'm not alone.
Yeah. And then there's two standout scenes with Elrond and Durin. There's one where Durin, he comes in and he says that they've managed to pull the dwarves out alive, but his father's shut down the dig because he was doing it behind his father's back in the first place. And, you know, he's basically, he's angry. he says that, you know, I don't care if I don't speak to the old man again. And there's a wonderful little speech by Elrond, and he talks about his father and how he looks up some days and wonders whether he's done his father proud or he's disappointed him. And he says that he would hear any judgment if he could have one more conversation with his father. Personally, for me, this was a really hard scene to watch because I lost my father to cancer 20 years ago.
Okay.
And you have those kind of regrets. You have, you know, you think about your last conversation, and luckily my last conversation with him wasn't in anger or anything like that. But you do have those thoughts. And I thought it was a really moving scene. And I thought that Robert Aramayo does a wonderful, wonderful job in this scene.
Yes, I think it was moving to me, you know, without the personal connection you yourself had, but even without that, it was moving to me. There's a number of things I liked about it, but yes, the way he delivers that speech, the fact that we get to learn something about his father, Arendil. I hope that Rings of Power touches a little more on his story, even though his story was long before, but it's nice that gets mentioned. And you got to give a nod to, you'll have to maybe help me out with the actor, but the actor who plays Durin.
Owen Arthur,
all right. He's been good already, but I think in this scene and then in the scene with his father, he took it to another level. It's really, really powerful. A bit of kind of acting by him. So got to give credit to that. And I also like the way it kind of, the humour that breaks that heavy moment with the story yes. about how they met. It's lovely. Punctuation to the scene, a lovely way to break the heavy subject matter and also give us a little bit of like backstory about how they met. So very, very smart way to bring that scene to a close.
Yeah, it's great. And I think for me, Elrond and Durin have the most natural relationship in this series so far. I love their kind of banter and how they talk to each other. And you get a sense of their deep history together. I mean, you got that when he first arrived in Moria, and how upset Prince Durin was that he hadn't come to visit him. So you really get a sense of their friendship and their history, and it's just coming more and more over these episodes. And it's one aspect I'm particularly enjoying.
Yeah, me too. I mean, yeah, you know, they had me at the moment where Elrond's there for dinner, and he, you know, when they're talking about the tree, that conversation where he says like, how can there not be, I can't remember, how can there not be light or something in a house with such love? From that moment, I was really on board with their relationship. And yeah. these scenes were just another development in that. Yeah. Bring on more.
Yeah, absolutely. And the scene that you just touched upon is where Durin goes to see his father, King Durin, played by Peter Mullen. Another fantastic scene. Where, you know, this theme of legacy, this theme of father to son, is quite prominent in these scenes, and I'm really enjoying it. And he talks about all the voices of the past kings weigh on him on the crown that he wears on his head, and you know he assures Durin that forgiveness is not required because he's always with him, and I really like that sentiment. And and then how the scene ends with Durin saying that he's been invited to Lindon.
Yeah, it's another really good scene, as you said, and I like how we really learn a bit more about the dwarves in this scene. How they see the kind of father son relationship, at least kingly father princely son relationship, and that kind of fierce loyalty that, you know, that they had, that dwarves have to their kin. Which we see in Durin's reaction as well to the four dwarves who have, you know, we don't know if they're alive or dead at that point. Schrodinger's dwarves, let's say. that, you know, his reaction, he's like, runs in, and then he's so angry, he's so upset. And so there's that. And then also the kind of suspicion when he says he's been invited to Lindon, and King Durin says, you know, about intuition's a powerful tonic. What does your intuition tell you? And Durin, even though it looks like everything's great between him and Elrond, he says he still thinks there's something more. And the king's response is like, good, you know,
yeah,
good son. It's right. It's right. It's virtuous for us to be suspicious, you know. And just I just loved how we got that insight, further insight into how the dwarves think, their values, how they live. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And how secretive they are, and how keeping their kind of secrets to themselves is very important. You know, which is evident when Durin is incredibly serious about Elrond keeping his oath about this must not leave this room. So even if he's suspicious of King Gil-galad, or you know, I think he trusts Elrond. I think Prince Durin, I think he realizes that maybe Elrond isn't involved in whatever King Gil-galad's ulterior motives are. I think he thinks that Elrond's free of guilt in that respect, which is why he trusted him. But yeah, it's going to be interesting now, because the elves have alternative motives towards the dwarves, and now the dwarves have an alternative motive to go to Lindon. So we've got these two kind of underlying secretive motivations from both species that are obviously going to clash at some point.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think Durin and us, the audience, is by now convinced that Elrond isn't aware. Mm. I think we suspect that Gil-galad's got some kind of plan or motivations. But I think that Durin and us, the audience, probably believes at this point that Elrond's innocent, which makes his reaction to the Mithril even more powerful, because right now it's only him who knows. It's only him who has the Feast of Mithril. And is it going to be a mistake? Is the appeal, the way he's kind of drawn to the Mithril, is that planting a seed in him which is going to lead to a bit of an accidental betrayal? Is he going to get slightly blindsided by Gil-galad and Celebrimbor? It's going to be really interesting, and I suspect a tiny bit heartbreaking, because it's going to be the beginning of potentially the decline of the relationship between Elrond and Durin. And that's we're just speaking about how much we enjoy it so far. So I'd like to see that a little while longer.
Yeah, it is going to be heartbreaking when it eventually happens. And we know what the relationship between elves and dwarves will be, because that's evident at the Council of Elrond in Lord of the Rings. The tension between Gimli and Legolas is evident. So
yeah,
they have not had good relations for a long time when we get there. So it is going to crumble. It is going to be destroyed. And it is going to be sad when Elrond and Durin have to part ways. It's going to be heartbreaking, because we are really invested. Well, at least me and you are really invested in their relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, there's so much bittersweet about Tolkien's universe and the books and the films, and that's, you know, like just the final scene at the Grey Havens of the trilogy. You know, it's amazing, but it breaks my heart every single time. Does that make me love it any less? No, but I think so. It's high fantasy, and that's one of the things we love about it, even though it sucks from time to time.
Yeah, indeed. Anything else that we missed that you want to mention about Elrond and the dwarfs, Durin, before we move on to Arondir and Bronwyn and Theo?
No, I think we covered it really well. Yeah, I think I've said what I wanted to say about those scenes. Just well done to the makers, because these scenes in Khazad Dûm with Elrond, Disa, Durin were really good in this episode.
Yeah, definitely. And credit to the writing as well. I know the writing's had a bit of a hit by some critics and some folk on Twitter or the social medias, but I think the writing's been particularly strong this episode, particularly with the dwarf and Elrond scenes, and also the Galadriel and Miriel scenes. I thought the writing's been top-notch.
Yeah, as you touched upon, that could be to do with the fact that the world-building and character introductions are largely done by this point, and the narrative can just rise up to the surface a bit more and give us that forward momentum. I didn't particularly feel like any of the other episodes were slow paced. I don't mind slow paced at all if it's serving a good purpose. But I do suspect that this episode, because of that forward momentum, was probably enjoyed a little bit more on the whole than the others for that reason.
Yeah, definitely. So moving on to Arondir and his encounter with Adar. This is a very intriguing scene with lots to kind of break down on this one. So Adar then, played by Joseph Moore, who some may recognise, who played Benjen Stark in Game of Thrones. Great actor, and he lends a right amount of power, creepiness, authority, and weird compassion for the orcs in this scene where he basically has to stop this orcs bleeding out and he's suffering and basically kills him. And then there's this weird rite that the orcs do and take off his armor. What did you think to this introduction to Adar?
You know, compassion was actually the exact word I used when I was talking about this after first watching the episode. And another word I used was reverence, because what we see in both movie trilogies is with the orcs is very authoritarian. It's very ruled with an iron fist. And often, you know, they're slaves who are whipped forward into battle. And this is different. I mean, not only have we seen a different side with the orcs in that they're a bit scarier, which we'll touch on with the Theo scenes. But this Adar character among them who shows compassion and the orcs revere is a really interesting thing. And what I like about it is it helps us remember that this is a different age. This is thousands of years before what we know as the movies. And maybe there were different dynamics. And you know, Sauron at this point as well has been gone a while. And, that you know, there might be a completely different way of life, if that's what your life is, what you call it for the orcs.
Torture.
a completely different way of torture and of enslavement. But another and wrapped up in that is the fact that they call him father. And he looks elven, and it's a lovely, another lovely mystery of like, okay, who are you? Why do you look like an elf? Why do they call you father? Why do you portray such a different character to the generals and leaders of orcs that we see in the trilogy? And another good mystery and another nice thought-provoking scene about the different dynamics, the different state of Middle-earth and its inhabitants in this age of Middle-earth.
I mean, there are some good clues in this episode to Adar and what he is. I mean, the orcs were once elves who were basically twisted and tortured by Morgoth. Adar looks like an elf, but his skin is sickly and grey and white, much like the orcs are. So maybe he is a particularly powerful elf who hasn't quite gone through the full transformation of being an orc. Adar means father in Quenyan, which is an Elvish language, which he speaks to Arondir in Quenyan. So he speaks Elvish as well. So there's lots of good layers going on in this episode. And also, I think it's either in the appendices or in my guide to Middle Earth, which basically just basically a huge dictionary of Middle Earth. Adar was a name that Sauron used at some point when he was in Middle Earth. So again, another contender who could possibly be Sauron, because Sauron was part of the Maia. He was one of the spirits that helped the Valar create the world. Morgoth was also part of the Valar. So these fallen angels, as it were, you know, it's a possibility that Adar could be Sauron. I would say he's more a contender for Sauron than the Stranger is at this point. But they, you know, as we mentioned earlier on, the writers are playing with lots of different contenders and just laying down clues, which could be red herrings and stuff like that. So it's just adds to the intrigue, I think, of who he is.
Yeah, I would agree that it's more likely him, Sauron, than the Stranger. But I still don't think it is. I mean, for a lot of the lore reasons in the lore that you've just touched upon, you know, that the elves, some elves were taken and enslaved in Morgoth's fortress, and as he looks elven, he's much more likely to be one of those. It's there's still like wonderfully curious question marks around. So why doesn't he look like an orc? Why do they call him father? Is it related to how the orcs spawn, or is it more symbolic? Yeah, and another thing I've read recently in the Silmarillion, or one of the parts of it, is that Sauron often, while he still could, before certain events, don't want to just needlessly go into spoilers, but before certain events, while he could, he still he often took a fair form of man, right? And you know, I'm not a complete expert. I don't know what of the many forms he could take, but he's. It's not a form of man, and it's not a fair form either that we see in Adar. So,
yeah.
Again, I don't want to get too deep into it because it's just, you know, you're along for the ride and don't want to overthink it and take away from the mystery, which is actually really enjoyable. But there's my little overview on it, my thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely something to think about, and I'm sure we'll gain more clues as we go along of who. Who Adar really is, and whether he's going to have a significance later on. So, lastly, then Bronwyn and Theo. Bronwyn doesn't get a whole lot to do this episode, but she's clearly struggling with trying to lead these people. They're now all in the refuge of Osterith, the Watchtower, and they're in desperate need of food. She doesn't want to go back to the village. Theo's saying, you know, that's where all the food is. We can go back in daylight. The orcs won't be out. We can get the food. We'll be fine. But she's just like, nope, let's try and scour the hills and the forest for food. So yeah, she doesn't get a whole lot to do, but it's Theo then, isn't it, with his friend Rowan, who go to the village. What do you think to these sequences of them getting food and then the clouds coming over? And all that, and Rowan running away, leaving his friend to die. Essentially, I was like, Rowan, you cowardly bastard. But anyway, what were your thoughts on all these scenes?
Yeah, Rowan's behaviour wasn't entirely surprising from from the little we've seen of him so far, and the general vibe there. Obviously, Theo is a much more intriguing character at this point. But yeah, it's been touched on in previous episodes of. This podcast that they're trying to make the orcs scary again, and my main takeaway from this is they're doing it well, and even though it was a bit like scenes horror scenes in the first things we've seen with orcs, because it's been in a enclosed space like one-on-one kind of fighting. This was different because now it's a bit more open in the village and there's a lot of orcs, but First, we get a bit of one-on-one fight scene between Theo and the orc in the house that he's in. But then it develops into the kind of more open village situation, but still scary. And I think it's just another thing that they're doing quite a good job with. That was my main takeaway, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think the set design and the scenery is fantastic. You know, it's all built, it's all practical.
Yeah.
Which I really love. There's not a whole amount of CG in these sequences. Well, there isn't any, I don't think, really. Yeah, it's a good tense making scene. I think Theo has got a lot of kind of street smarts, you know, jumping into the well and hiding in there and diving under the water. I think that just shows, you know, he's a brave little guy.
Yeah.
If a little reckless. But it's interesting how here we get this idea that the orcs, and particularly Adar, have been after this hilt, whatever it is. So that was a really interesting point in these scenes, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, when it's dark and he's trying to make his way through the village and they're all like, get the hilt. And he says, oh, okay. So what does this mean? Because we've been introduced to this and Theo's had it and he's used it to a certain extent. Oh, by the way, it was very cool when he kind of instinctively knew to dig it into his arm to kind of fuel it, I guess. We don't know much about that yet, but that was a little cool moment. But yeah, it's a nice reveal. It makes you go, oh, okay, you know, this is more serious. This is more serious than we think. This is not going to have good effects for Theo or the people, his people. That was nice. And while we're on that scene, I loved the camera work. When he's trying to get through the village, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Just, you know, that kind of hand, I assume handheld camera moving behind him. And yeah, really, really kind of puts you in his position, which in turn makes you feel that fear. You know, so again, making the orcs scary. And then kind of, you know, classic horror moment where he thinks he's through and he turns a corner and then is grabbed. Really good.
Yeah, and then, of course, Arondir to the rescue. I do like his kind of entrance into this scene, and he takes the orc out from behind, and you see it's Arondir, and you're like, yay!
Yeah.
So he's pretty badass, Arondir. I do like him. Yeah, so he helps Theo escape through the woods with a lot of slow-mo.
Yeah.
I do think they over-egg the slow-mo just a little bit through this scene, this chasing. I would have liked to have seen some normal speed chasing mixed with a bit of slow-mo, but it's all slow-mo, which is lovely because you get that lovely choral music. But my only criticism, real criticism of the show so far, is that I do think they over-egg the slow-mo just a tad too much, personally for me anyway.
I mostly agree. I think it was certainly a better use of slow-mo than in episode 3. When
with the horse,
when they're riding the horses, just like ultra slow mo and like ultra slow close up on Galadriel's face, which like no, that's not going to do any face any favors because we're just not used to seeing people's facial skin move in such. So I just like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
This was much better than that, but I don't know if it worked better if it had been like 50-50 or if it was intermittently slow-mo and then, you know, full speed. The music helped and I enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed the slow-mo more than that in episode 3, but there's still question marks over it. Yeah, it's still a bit over the top probably and a little bit unnecessary, but
yeah,
I enjoyed it overall.
I mean, a good example of how they kind of do it intermittently is the end of Fellowship of the Ring with Boromir. And there's a real good mix of normal speed fighting mixed with a bit of slow-mo. And that I think it has more effect that way. Whereas in here, it was just full slow-mo through that entire forest.
Yeah, and they could have really echoed that scene as well, couldn't they? Because it was a forest. There was like arrows going into tree trunks. There was a lot evoking that scene with Boromir. They didn't go that way, and perhaps it would have been better if they did.
But as they emerge from the forest and you get that the sunrise, there are some stunning shots where you get the clouds kind of wisping over the hills and the sun coming up. It's beautifully shot.
Yeah, I agree.
So we get Arondir delivering Adar's message to Bronwyn. Basically, they need to either swear fealty to Adar or be destroyed at Osterith. Again, this kind of reminded me of in Lord of the Rings, where the men of the South swear fealty to Sauron. So this history of the Southlands is kind of being created here, and why the men of the South in the Third Age joined Sauron. So it's a nice kind of echoing of that.
Yes, it is. And because obviously we see very little of that in the films, very little of why the men of the South do what they do. We just really get their arrival into the war. So all of that is good history that we haven't really seen much of. Is it just me? Or did you get really strong Helm's Deep vibes?
Definitely. Yeah. Refugees in this haven of this, fortified place. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely got some Helm's Deep vibes.
Yeah. I think it's intentional because I think that like the kind of background music and even the shots, I think it's really hinting that way. And I hope they kind of subvert our expectations a little bit. And the whatever goes down there is not just a siege. I'm actually quite intrigued by the possibility of some kind of civil battle happening first, but possibly led by Bronwyn versus, I think his name's Waldrick, that old guy who confronts Theo about the hilt. I think there's a nice bit of potential there for some butting of heads and something to happen that subverts the expectations and they do something different, not just a mini Helm's Deep.
Yeah, 100%. And that scene where the old man and Theo have a chat and he, you know, it was his hilt because Theo stole it from his barn. What's the old guy's name again?
Waldrick,
yeah. So Theo stole the hilt from Waldrick's warehouse. They both now bear the mark or the sigil of Sauron on their forearm. So this idea of a split between these guys, I think, is very possible. I think you've hit on something that could is a good possibility. And yeah, the name of, he knows the name of Sauron, which is a very interesting point as well.
Yeah, I loved how it was delivered, where he says, "Have you heard the name, boy? Have you heard of Sauron?" And the way he said it was, I think there was effects on his voice, and I could almost see the eye of Sauron when he said it. You know, just because the effects on the voice and the way it was, delivered. But it's intriguing to see what happens to Theo, because anything could happen to him. Really, he could rise up against this temptation, and he could side with the Numenoreans or the elves, or he could become the Witch King of Angmar. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
It is. What do you think to the young actor who plays Theo, Tyro Mujahideen? I think, I'm sorry if I butchered that surname. What do you think to this young lad?
Honestly, I haven't thought about it too much, which probably tells me that he's doing a fine job. You know, he's doing fine. What do you think?
I think he's one of the weakest links in terms of acting, but I think he's doing a fine job. He's doing a good job, and he's not so bad that I'm just like, I don't like this character, kill him off. But, you know, so, yeah, he's doing an okay job, but I think in terms of the calibre of actors that we've got on the show, I think. But he's a young lad, so, you know, and I don't think I've ever seen him in anything else, so it might be his first big kind of acting role, but he's doing okay. He's doing all right.
Yeah, maybe he'll grow into it. I hope he does. I hope he does, obviously, especially if they have got plans for him to be someone meaningful. So, yeah, we'll see.
Definitely. Anything else you want to mention about this scene or any other scenes? I think we covered pretty much all the different narrative strands going on through this episode.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. You actually mentioned this earlier on in our conversation, but Baldrig actually references the Starfall as a sign of Sauron. And I really don't think that he's saying that the person who fell in the star is Sauron. It's more of like the way Galadriel's arrival onto Numenor signals a step in the prophecy. You know, it's she's not the downfall of Numenor. And I don't think the stranger is Sauron. But what I really, really liked is the intrigue of what does Waldrig know? Because he knows something. He knows that Starfall signifies something related to Sauron. So what else does he know? And what is he going to do about it? He hasn't tried to snatch the hilt off Theo yet. He's actually egging him on in some respects. So what does he know? What's going to happen there? And when he says, like, it is no sword, it's a power, what does that mean? So lots of intrigue in that little interaction.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, is he, you know, these men of the South, they allied with Morgoth during the war in the Second Age, in the First Age. So are there still loyal allies of Morgoth around? Is Waldrig a loyal ally? So it's a very interesting, lots of stuff going on in a little scene. They managed to pack in a hell of a lot through this episode, and managed to make the episode a forward driving cohesive episode. And I think it's a really, really well crafted episode, this one.
Yes, I agree. We've spoken very positively about it, and I haven't spoken to many people yet. In fact, even our Discord has been a little bit quieter about this episode than the others. So it'd be interesting to know what the wider world, the wider audience thinks about it.
Definitely.
But we clearly really enjoyed it. And, you know, I think the reasons we've given are very valid, and, you know, explained it well. So I am curious to know what other people think. But I'm pretty confident to say, like, kudos to the writers. Because they achieved quite a lot in this in this episode, as did the actors. Many of them gave really good performances in these scenes.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we've ended with Miriel deciding to take Galadriel to Middle-earth. So we've got Miriel, we've got Elrond, we've got Isildur, all making their way across the seas to Middle-earth. So things are cooking quite nicely now.
They certainly are, and it's going to be very interesting to see what Numenor does, because we only get broad strokes on the actions of Numenor as a whole in the books at this point, and to how they go to Middle-earth and what they do there, and how Elendil and Isildur become who they become. It's going to be a huge part of the show, and it's going to be one personally I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. I'm really, really quite happy with the way things are going in the show at the minute, so I'm looking forward to next week.
Yes, as do I, especially the Durin being in Lindon.
Yes, it's going to be good fun.
Hopefully we get to see that in the next episode, and they don't give us another dwarf break.
Yeah.
We'll have
more dwarves.
We'll have 46 minutes of Harfoots next episode. Although I do want to see the stranger, you know, so that's okay.
Yes, definitely. Well, Sam, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today about Rings of Power. Where can people find you on the network? And have you got any other projects you'd like to plug that you do?
I just want to plug my podcast on the We Made This Network, which is the Den of Ten podcast, where we do top 10 lists of lists mostly related around film, music, TV, a couple on video games so far, and we've got some other kind of topics. We've just done our first topic outside of those things, which was about top accents in the British Isles, which is quite fun to do, try and recreate some of those accents. But yeah, generally we're doing top 10 lists of different movies, TV shows, actors, music from different decades and different genres. And as me and my co-host are both massive Lord of the Rings fans, I think we should probably do a Lord of the Rings related episode soon, whether it be I don't know, best scenes from the trilogy or best characters or something like that. You know, it's not something objective that we take seriously, but as fans,
top 10 slow motion scenes.
Top 10 slow mo scenes. I'm not sure that that one on the beach with the horses will make it. Into that.
No,
but you'd be welcome if we do that. You'd be welcome as a guest.
That'd be great fun.
We're on Twitter at Den of Ten Pod, and of course you can listen to us on Apple Music, Spotify, all of the usuals, as you can with all of the We Made This podcasts.
Brilliant, good fun. You can find me on Twitter at Luke_Winch. I am also on the We Made This network with my Fringe podcast called Observing the Pattern. We are currently analysing season 4 episode by episode. I also do a podcast with Baz, my co-host on here. We also do a Babylon 5 podcast, A Dream Given Form. At the minute, we're doing monthly episodes on the general broad themes and concepts of Babylon 5. And then from February, we'll be doing every single episode of all 5 years of Babylon 5. So we're really looking forward to that. Thanks for joining us for another episode of One Rules Them All. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to One Rules Them All. And if you can give us a rating review on Apple Podcasts, that would be fantastic. Next week, we're back. I'm hosting again, and I'll be joined by my lovely friend, Clara Cook. We'll be discussing episode 5 then. So until then, remember, even the smallest person can change the course of the future.